And our two guests tonight, David Talbot, Wallace Thornhill, as we talk about the electric universe and the thunderbolts of the gods. We'll be back with them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. David, what was once thought then of just a void in the universe between objects is not the case anymore, is it?
That's it exactly, George. We always grew up with the idea of a disconnected universe. These were just objects separated by immense distances of empty space. And now we know that space is filled with charged particles. That's really the definition of a plasma, presence of charged particles. And we know that there are magnetic fields that are stretching across vast intergalactic distances. And these magnetic fields reveal themselves to us as filaments, filamentary threads across huge distances in space are the witnesses to magnetic fields and the electric currents that create magnetic fields. So this is a connected universe, and now we have the opportunity to view this universe across the whole electromagnetic spectrum, and we are seeing highly energetic activity in space now. That's the subject of the electric universe, which we just published a few months ago, and the message of that book is that a revolution now is coming in which the scientific community must come to grips with the electric force in the cosmos.
David, and I'm going to also ask you, Wallace, you know, 2012 is not too far away. It's the end date of the Mayan calendar, of which so many people are theorizing so many different things. I happen to believe it could be some kind of solar event or some kind of universal event. The Mayans, for some reason, knew something. Might this be tied into the electric universe?
You know, George, you're on an exotic subject there in which I really do not have a basis for any conclusion at all, except this. And this is just a cautionary note because I don't know what other people are working with evidentially. But when it comes to calendars, I always want to register a caution with folks because most calendars were developed, were formulated in order to anticipate the recurrence of doomsday. Now, you see this in the Aztec and the Maya calendars continuously, like the Aztec 52-year cycle. That's really part of a systematic ritual anticipation of the end of the world. And so after 52 years, yes, they would run out into the streets and celebrate the renewal in life because they would look up at Venus and see that it was business as usual up there. Now, when the zeros on our calendar lined up in 2000, mm-hmm. that was preceded by a great deal of anxiety. And that's the same doomsday anxiety. Every calendar on Earth in ancient times really had this purpose of enabling astronomers and astronomer priests to see what was around the bend, but they were never accurate. The systems turn out to be arbitrary. So I can't tell you that there's nothing to the 2012 concerns of people, and I see things coming to me that actually look quite interesting, but with respect to 2012, I'd have to be one of the skeptics because I have never observed anyone anticipating catastrophe on a large scale.
How about you, Wallace? Do you look into the Mayan calendar end date?
No. In fact, I agree with David. pardon me. I think the interesting point is that we still are subject to the fears of the ancients. It's as if we've been imprinted somehow, like baby birds that freeze at the shadow of a hawk overhead. And I think that part of the fallout of the electric universe model is an understanding of our history, which will allow us to deal with these, what I would call, irrational beliefs from the past. So, and then a more rational approach to both the way we live our lives and the way we deal with our planet. So that's my take on it.
Go ahead.
There is just an observation that is really kind of crying out now for recognition, and that is doomsday anxiety itself is so pervasive, and its components are so common from one culture to another.
And it's always been around, doomsday fear.
Exactly, and in the end, we must ask the completely rational question, where did this content of this fear come from? I mean, this is a fear of the end of the world. This is a fear of devastating catastrophe. Now, why is it, George, that when a little wisp of gas comes into view as a comet, the world was thrown into terror? It is because that little wisp of gas was a reminder of the great comet that presided over the end of the world, mythologically. Devastating, world-altering, heaven-altering catastrophe, the most terrifying event in human history. So doomsday anxiety deserves to be analyzed and brought into the light of day. That will alone do the most to free us from the irrational levels of that anxiety.
Well, is there a fear that we're going to get hit by a comet one day? I mean, we've talked about the asteroids. We're trying to track them. But I don't hear a lot of people talking about us getting zapped by a comet.
Well, asteroids and comets are actually both fairly popular in scientific literature now. And this has actually become part of sort of a funding direction that theoretical science has taken, the search for potentially Earth-threatening asteroids is now a top item on the agenda for public funding in planetary science. And we would bring a little bit of a different perspective to this, George. It's not that we exclude the possibilities or exclude this concern or dismiss it, but the nature of the cometary catastrophe in the past was just overwhelming, and it was not anything like what they talk about in their descriptions of an asteroid hitting the Earth. This was a blazing, fierce, heaven-spanning phenomenon in the sky. What was the angry goddess of the world's great tradition? She's raging across the sky,
yes,
setting everything aflame, and she is associated with the planet Venus. The planet Venus was identified as the mother of life and also as the terrible goddess who, in her anger, nearly destroyed the world. And this was not a rock coming in and hitting the Earth. And in electrical terms, Wall will have to address this, but in electrical terms, there is reason to doubt that an incoming rock would survive the electric field of the Earth. And Wall, maybe you would like to just address that for a moment.
Yeah, sure.
Sure.
But first, I'd like to say that the search for a near-Earth object is another manifestation of the doomsday fear,
mm-hmm,
and it's played upon it. Yes, when you have an object highly charged like a comet coming towards the Earth, before it strikes the Earth, there will be an electrical discharge between the two bodies, and that discharge will usually be of sufficient magnitude to destroy the incoming object so that you would end up with a shower of sand and stuff like that. However, the electrical discharge between the two bodies can cause a significant damage on Earth. I think the Tunguska event in Siberia is an example where the object never actually hit the Earth.
Right.
Electrical discharge phenomena at the surface of the Earth, which was witnessed, of course.
And obliterated hundreds of thousands of acres.
That's right. Yes. So, and there was also the famous Chicago fires, where that whole area of the U.S. was lit up by strange fires and falls of sand and such like. And this occurred at the time of the disappearance of Biela's comet. So the traditional picture of what I call the pie in the face model of asteroid impact, where you see this object striking the Earth and great gouts of water from the ocean shooting into the towards space and so on, is completely wrong. There's not a sign of a lightning discharge anywhere in that picture, which makes it wrong, because the ancients said that the close approach of the celestial bodies was also a time of the celestial thunderbolt.
Indeed, and so that's the nature of the thunderbolts of the gods. And something just occurs to me as we're speaking here, George, and this is actually another door that is opening. There's a great fascination on the part of mainstream scientists today with the possibility that there is a thread of ancient mythology relating directly to cometary catastrophe, and they barely touch the myths. But what will happen, because they are giving that first hint of credence to ancient testimony, but they are going to be in for one devil of a surprise the moment they begin to take ancient testimony seriously, because they will right now be very selective in looking for testimony that supports an abstract physical hypothesis. A rock came in and hit here and created these results, and look, here are these stories that seem to support that. But once they begin to treat with any seriousness the phenomenon of human memory in ancient times and all the devices that were used anciently to record events, they are going to find that there is this vast reservoir, a library of records relating to the great comet and the terror that was unleashed amongst humanity and the ways in which civilizations on Earth responded to that sense of doom or threat ritually. And this, every ritual that was part of that magical response by the ancient cultures is evidence for us. It's telling us something about the nature of the event. And it's not going to look anything like what they're writing books on today.
David, we were talking last hour about how the planets were so closely aligned some time ago, and what a view that would be from good old planet Earth. I mean, Mars must have been huge. One of our regular guests, Richard Hoagland, he has theorized that he believes that there was another planet which orbited Mars, and there was an internal explosion there, and it's probably the main reason Mars might have lost whatever atmosphere it had at the time.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
Well, there is something enchanting in the general concept of the exploding planet or moon. Now, we are very closely aligned to Tom Van Flandern, the astronomer,
yes,
on this particular
right
point.
And Richard's close with him on that too.
He's one of the pioneers of the exploding planet hypothesis, and there is an overlap in our interpretations of asteroids and small rocks and comets and so on in the solar system. And I do believe that Tom Van Flandern himself says that comets are not icy bodies, but largely just rocks on different orbits, generally on different orbits than asteroids, but the same constituent material. And all of us are saying that asteroids and comets and meteorites are substantially the remains of explosions in the solar system. That's either an exploding moon or material torn from a planet by electric discharge.
But not a planet that didn't form, which so many other scientists believe the asteroid belt could be.
Yeah, that's, to me, that's just stretching credulity completely. Now, Wall was the one who really convinced me that electrical discharge, removal of surface material from Mars and from moons of Jupiter and Saturn, is the primary source of the residual material we see roaming the asteroid belts and other regions of the solar system.
Do we know, David, if we were to accumulate all the known asteroids in the asteroid belt and put them together like you would a snowball, how big would it be?
You know what, George, I've heard the answer to that question from a dependable authority, and I'm not remembering what that answer was. Do you have an answer to that, Wall?
No, I don't offhand. I seem to recall it was a fairly small body, though.
A smaller body. Okay.
Yes.
Maybe then it could have been a moon of another planet.
If you followed Tom Van Flanden's line of reasoning, that's true. However, Tom had no really plausible explanation for why a planet should explode. The electrical model deals with this as a natural consequence of the things that were witnessed by the ancients. And the ancients also talked about the thunderbolts being associated with falls of rock from the sky.
Exactly.
So the two are tied together by the ancients, and I would believe their testimony first and foremost.
Well, there was an old One Step Beyond show of an old Western town, and rocks would fall from the sky. And, you know, they thought it was something, you know, very demonic or very weird.
George, the ancient chroniclers, poets, historians, and philosophers identified meteorites as coming from the planet Mars.
Hmm.
Now, on the planet Mars, there is one immense chasm. It's called the Valles Marineris. It was Ralph Jurgens, the engineer with whom I was closely associated in the 70s, who said that huge trench was carved by an electric arc in a planetary exchange, a planetary encounter. And I held that possibility in my mind as I was working with the historical investigation, and I began to notice these images of a warrior hero figure, a cosmic figure, wielder of the cosmic thunderbolt and so on, who I called the scar-faced figure. Now, in the end, I realized that the mythical images of the great scarred warrior, he has this gash across his forehead or his cheek or his thigh, and in more than one account, that scar is created by a thunderbolt. And when Wall visited me in 1997, I asked him if he could imagine the Valles Marineris, as Jurgens had postulated, actually being carved out by an electric discharge. And Wall pulled out his slides, and what he showed me satisfied me that there is actually compelling physical evidence that that was indeed carved by an electric arc. So there is a convergence here of the mythological image of the scarred warrior hero, the scar-faced motif, where the scar is created by a thunderbolt, and the actual physical evidence. Now, if in close encounters with Mars, material from that great chasm, which would swallow hundreds of Grand Canyons, if that material was catapulted into space along with a great deal of dust, we would have a very direct and simple explanation for the number of meteorites that they're now identifying as coming from Mars chemically, and the falls of red dust on the Earth. But you have to keep in mind, when they identify a meteorite from Mars, they're doing that on the basis of an atmospheric signature in soil.
Exactly.
And exactly. The thunderbolt that cut out the Valles Marineris would have excavated 1,000 times more material that would not have that signature, because it would be down in the bedrock and so on.
What planet did that arc come from, David?
I'm quite confident it was from Venus. There was this violent exchange going on between Venus and Mars in ancient times.
Had Venus already been captured by that point?
Not captured in the sense that it was in its present orbit. No.
Okay.
This was a planetary configuration that provoked the great myths of world mythology.
Let's talk about that when we come back. That's an incredible story. Tell us when you think that might have occurred. I'll be back in a moment with David Talbot, Wallace Thornhill. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with them. Then that'll be it. I'll be back. Okay, for you Streamlink members, you get a chance to chat with Ian Punnett tomorrow, our host of our Saturday night program. It starts at 8 o'clock Pacific time, so jump on board. The seats fill up awfully fast. Streamlink members, you get to Question and Answers with Ian Punnett tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Pacific time. David, let's pick up and talk about Venus, the break goddess, and then you were right in the middle of something pretty interesting there.
Yes, okay.
It is a violent, violent history that the ancients talked about. So here's the question. Were they witnesses to this event?
Boy, they sure were.
All right, what would it look like? Kind of, if we were on the planet then, tell us what we would be seeing.
What did Venus look like?
Coming in.
The paradox here is that to describe the appearance of Venus does require you to see also other planets with which it was engaged. And in fact, it is... It's one of the greatest difficulties we have in communication, George, is to make this clear in words only. I can tell you that this coming year, what was seen in the sky is going to be presented in sufficient detail up on Google Video that it will make this communications challenge much, much easier for us.
Okay.
But if you can imagine the sphere of the planet Venus with streamers radiating out from it as electrical discharge filaments, and at the same time that planet was engaged electrically with the planet Mars in various ways, at one time that there is a spiraling streamer that rushes out from the planet Mars to connect with Venus.
God.
So there was a dance going on in the sky. This was, in fact, the sidelock of the warrior hero. There is a reason for the kinds of images
mm-hmm.
that we see in antiquity.
Okay.
Why does the warrior hero figure so consistently find identification with the planet Mars? That's a huge mystery globally. And why does he wear a sidelock that is identified as the Mother Goddess? Now, if you go back to the first formulations of cosmic imagery in ancient Egypt, there are very few images that are more clearly recognizable than the sidelock of the warrior hero figure Horus that is called Hinsektet. Now, Hinsektet was the mother goddess Isis. So there is a history of this spiraling sidelock, which turns out to be the history of the cosmic serpent. And this can be reconstructed from Egypt to Mesopotamia to China to the Americas. It's a complex history, but ultimately it can be reduced to very simple glimpses visually. A huge sphere in the sky, the planet Mars, very close to the Earth, with material spiraling off of Mars.
And how many millions of miles away do you think from Earth?
I don't know if I would count that distance in millions. It was huge. It was taking, in its closest approach, it was taking up, let's just say, 20 degrees in the sky. The moon takes up a half a degree today.
Oh, my God.
We're talking about this stupendous...
I mean, it was like blocking...
...over pressing in on the Earth.
It blocked 20% of the sky, you're saying, basically.
Yeah. Let's just say, in its closer approach, it took up 20 degrees of arc.
All right. And if it was illuminated by the sun...
Yeah,
we didn't have nighttime on this planet then.
Well, there is a lot of evidence that the clear distinction between night and day as we experience this day was not experienced by our early ancestors. But this, again, it's a complicated picture when you're just capturing or catching glimpses from a verbal description. Way back in 1996, Ben Gedlow, a Canadian filmmaker, did a 90-minute documentary called Remembering the End of the World, which was the story of this reconstruction, oversimplified substantially, but it does visually, that documentary, Remembering the End of the World, does visually capture glimpses of this close congregation of planets and what was occurring between them. The remarkable thing here is that I reconstructed all of that not knowing what a plasma is, not knowing anything about the electric universe. That was in 1996. It was the next year that Wall arrived and said, Dave, What you've reconstructed are electrical discharge configurations. And he was completely convincing. And then the world just changed because I didn't have a basis for a discussion with a scientist until Wall arrived. Then I had a basis for talking with scientists. Look, these are the images that were seen. And look, here are the formations taken by plasma discharge. That's how I ended up affecting the life's work of the plasma scientist, Tony Perrat. He saw the formations that I had reconstructed. He saw the rock art images that I had conveyed to him. And he said, well, now, wait a minute. I've spent much of my life looking at plasma discharge in the laboratory. That's what this is. And that's changed the direction of his own life's work. Every time I mention Tony Perrat, I have to remind people he is not a Velikovskian. He is a traditional scientist. He's part of the scientific mainstream. He's doing his own work on this. He is going to let the computer determine what people were recording around the world. He's not going to be affected by anything I might interpret. And this is where we are now. It's a huge opening for us, and it is coming into the public domain fast enough that I can just assure people, George, that within the next year or two, you're going to have definitive material available to you as to what was seen in the sky, how it was interpreted mythologically, were the planets involved in this, or was it just an intense electrical effect such as an aurora or that sort of thing?
Well, the title of Velikovsky's book, of course, Worlds in Collision, one would ascertain that these objects were colliding with each other constantly. Is that the case?
Well, actually more so in my own reconstruction than in Velikovsky's. There's some clarification that is necessary here, and I'm a little bit nervous about not bringing you, Wall, into this.
I was going to say, Dave, that one of the tests of a good theory is that you can make an outrageous predictions in advance of discovery. And I
Absolutely.
Should say that on the basis of the reconstruction that Dave had done, I was the only person on planet Earth that predicted what would be found beneath the clouds of Saturn's moon, Titan, when that lander drifted down beneath the clouds and started taking photographs.
Really? Okay, well, the predictive ability is going to be the heart of all of this in the end, and it's the only final test of a theory, is how well it can predict the data in hand and how well it can anticipate the data yet to be received. And we have had the most I'm going to have to let you take over.
You're so excited here. Get some water there. We'll have you pick up, Wolf.
Yeah, I think that what Dave was leading up to was the Deep Impact mission, where as soon as it was agreed that the project would go ahead, and 4 years before the event, I predicted that there would be a flash before the main flash and that it would be far more energetic than anyone expected. Now, that is another example of an outlandish prediction. No one else even gave any thought to being two flashes, and yet it did happen, and the astronomers were amazed and had difficulty in explaining it away.
And the electric model also predicted that the surface of Temple would be very sharply sculpted. On the Thunderbolt site, we predicted the flat-floored valleys and the mesas and so on. Now, if a comet is just an icy body evaporating in the warmth of the sun, it's going to have a very smooth surface. But instead, in the close-up images of Temple, you saw an incredibly sharp relief. Wall Thornhill predicted that because of the electrical nature of that body and the incoming copper projectile, that the effect would be substantial enough, despite the fact that the comet was miles wide and the projectile is just an 800-pound copper object, that it would redistribute the jets of the comet. And that is exactly what happened. And in just gravitational or kinetic impact terms, it's inconceivable that that would happen. But electrically, it was a logical prediction, and it was correct. No one else in science today, George, enjoyed any real success in anticipating these extraordinary outcomes of the Deep Impact mission.
Are you both saying, though, that let's say for some horrible reason, good old planet Earth was leaving its orbit and was rushing at 22,000 some miles an hour. Would it turn into a comet? Could it?
Yes. Yes.
My God.
If it was moving through the radial electric field of the sun, it would become a comet. And that's exactly why Venus became a comet. And it is evident that in some form or another, the planet Saturn, with which we were intimately joined for a period, developed a cometary sheath, and that we were actually inside that cometary sheath. Now, I mean, that's just too extraordinary for words, but there's evidence for this. Number one, the planet Saturn was this towering form in the sky. Saturn is mythologically the archaic sun god, the primeval sun god before the present sun, and the attributes of that mythical figure are very well defined. It is the stationary sun, the central sun, and it is the sun ruling in the sky as the first in the line of kings. There's meaning to all of these things, but it has to be carefully drawn out. But why would a little speck in the sky today be identified by the world's first astronomers as the archaic sun god? The Babylonian, Assyrian magical astrological texts say of Shamash, the sun god. Everyone recognizes that he is the sun god. They say Shamash is the planet Saturn. Even the names Helios and Sol, the most familiar names of the sun to us today, were archaically the names of Saturn. This is completely enigmatic. But they drew pictures of these formations in the sky, and you can see exactly what Saturn looked like in the relationship to Venus and the relationship to Mars in this primeval configuration that dominated human imagination around the world. And they were drawing pictures of these forms in the sky, and they were building towering monuments to these forms in the sky, and recording myths and in their storytelling, recounting what occurred in the lives of these bodies. Story's incredibly coherent from one culture to another. The moment you look past the surface contradictions and you keep your eyes fixed on the points of agreement, because every culture was very self-serving in the way it told stories and accumulating details that completely contradicted the stories of other cultures, but they were working with an inherited tradition that is unified, and you expose that unified tradition by just staying with the points of agreement. That's a completely integral substructure of human memory. It's very reliable, and that's what I believe we will, within the next 2 years, present a completely convincing argument that humanity experienced things that have never even entered the minds of scientists today.
Could these catastrophes occur again and take us out, wipe us out?
This is always a possibility. And Wal, what's your perspective on a recurrence of a doomsday event?
You know, basically, it was the capture of a brown dwarf star, which we call Saturn now. Pardon me, I've got a frog too.
Sure. The
same kind of thing could happen again. I mean, if it's happened once in the past, it could happen again. And that would be the thing to look out for. But we would have plenty of warning because the electrical interactions of the sun and a brown dwarf star, as they both, their electrical environments clashed, would be quite spectacular.
Would we, when you talk about this warning, would things happen on this planet? Would we lose, you know, would the power grids go out and things like that?
Yes, there would be some fluctuations. It would depend on the size of the incoming star. If it was a small, if it was a brown dwarf like Saturn, the effect on the sun would be almost unnoticeable, I think. But the effect on the brown dwarf would be considerable to the extent that it would form the most stupendous comet we've ever seen in the sky.
Is there anything out there now, Wallace, that could be deemed a possible threat to us?
Not that I know of. Now that we have very good infrared telescopes scanning the skies, it seems to me that we would have a good advance warning of a brown dwarf, but we would have to be looking towards the solar apex, in other words, the direction the sun is traveling, and also where we've come from to look for such an interloper. It wouldn't come in from in the plane of the planets.
David, are you familiar at all with the work of Zechariah Sitchin?
I am. Okay. I got to know him a little bit back in 97. He spoke at the same conference that Wall attended when he spent that time in my office in 97. And I found him to be a very affable fellow, and I did find some points of common interest with him. One was the historic memory of a doomsday event.
Exactly. And let's not talk about the possibilities of the extraterrestrial visitation, but let's talk about his theory that there's another planet in the solar system that's on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit.
Yes.
Is that possible?
I think it is possible, but in terms of historical evidence, I just believe that you can be much more precise, that what occurred in ancient times can be reconstructed down to very fine details. And it requires a certain methodology, as I was saying, and it requires you to be open to whatever the myths, the historical memories are saying, no matter how unusual. As long as you are staying with the archetypes, these are the universal memories, you are on very reliable ground. But it's still, you have to connect the pieces, because every archetype, every universal theme is inseparably connected to every other. The important thing to keep in mind here is that there was a myth-making epoch. There was a phase of human history that provoked all of the stories. After that period ended, there was never a new archetype that entered human history. In other words, this was human imagination just exploding in response to these extraordinary events in the sky. And the only tools that humanity had were symbolic. And they were working with different symbols pointing to the same things. So there is a coherent substructure of human memory that can be reconstructed. And you name a theme of myth, George, and name another theme of myth that you're familiar with, and I can tell you exactly how they related to each other. There are no isolated themes of world mythology. So the point here is that it isn't necessary to take just a little thread of myths and try to build a hypothesis on that. What we have is a vast library that enables us to reconstruct the ancient experience down to extraordinary levels of detail. It's here that I would depart from Zechariah Sitchin, and this is quite apart from the extraterrestrial issues.
Right. Well, that's fascinating, though. And so the big question is it could possibly happen again, and we might have some warning. You know, they say that dinosaurs were killed by an asteroid. Now they're beginning to think maybe it was volcanic action that took them in. How do we know it wasn't some kind of arcing problem that created that?
I think we can almost guarantee that it was.
All right, let's talk about that when we come back. And then, I've always believed that there's a purpose for everything. Why is the universe so laden with electrical forces? We'll be back and take your calls.